Welcome to the Real Estate Pod from St. John's Chambers. I'm Brittany Pierce, and with me is Daniel Saw. We're both members of the Chancery and Commercial team here at St. John's. The aim of this podcast is to share our first-hand experience of what does and doesn't work in court. We'll also summarise and offer our insights into new developments and discuss the implications of key cases in property law. In this episode, Dan and I are discussing the litigation of boundary disputes. We'll discuss some of the cases that we've worked on, what evidence should be obtained and who should give evidence, and give some practical hints and tips. So I think we'll start off with what boundary disputes are and how they're resolved. I suspect most listeners are going to recognise a boundary dispute when they see one, but Dan, it might be helpful if you can give us an overview of how the court or tribunal actually decides where a boundary is.
Yeah. So if the neighbours can't sort things amicably, then they'll have to ask the court or tribunal to determine where the boundary lies. The court will do this by looking and finding the original conveyance which separated the two parcels of land. The subsequent transfers aren't going to be of much use because they will have just transferred on what was originally divided. So you have to find the conveyance or the transfer which actually separated the two parcels. And then it is a matter of construing that document. And the court will go about that by looking at the words of the conveyance and also looking at any plan which is attached to the conveyance. Now, some difficulties may arise in circumstances where the conveyance is vague in the parcels clause when it's talking about the land that is being conveyed, but refers to a plan, and it refers to the plan as being for the purposes of identification only. Now, the plan might be very detailed and show exactly where the boundaries are, but courts have found that when a conveyance refers to a plan as for being for the purposes of identification only, that it's the words of the transfer or conveyance that are going to be preferred over the detail of the plan. But at the end of the day, the court's task is simply to construe the document as a whole, including the parcels clause and the plan, to find exactly where that boundary is. When the plan isn't clear enough and doesn't give, for example, exact dimensions, then also the court will have regard to what the topographical features of the land was as at the date of the transfer. And that's key, to look at the features at the date of the transfer, not since, not as the features are now. Because the court will put themselves in the position of the purchaser, holding the conveyance in their hand, standing on the land and looking at the features, to decide what would the reasonable purchaser have understood to have been purchasing when looking at the transfer or conveyance and standing on the plot of land.
And outside of that, you've also got a possibility that the boundary might have changed because, for instance, there's a boundary agreement has been reached, or you might be able to argue that even though the boundary used to be in one spot, it's actually shifted as a result of adverse possession.
Yeah, so adverse possession can occur when you have possessed a bit of land for a certain amount of time, depending on whether the land is registered or unregistered. So what you're looking for is whether there's been an existing state of affairs for a long time, which is different to where the original conveyance says the boundary lies. So, for example, if you have an enclosed garden and the boundary feature, the fence or whatever it might be, is in a position different to where the conveyance says the legal boundary actually is, then you might be able to argue that you have adversely possessed the portion of the land belonging to your neighbour if it's within your physical boundaries and it has been for a long time. If it's unregistered land, then you're looking for 12 years. And if it's registered land, you're looking at 10 years, but you have to have a reasonable belief that the land formed part of your land, that it lay within your boundary. So you've got to watch out for that, because even if the original conveyance supports your case, if your neighbour has enclosed the land for a long time, then the original conveyance might not be enough. Brittany, you've recently had a case, haven't you, to do with boundary agreements?
That's right. So this was a pair of adjacent plots on a residential street in urban Cheltenham. And historically, the plots had terraced houses on them. So the defendant's plot had a mid-terrace property on it. My client owned land that would have had the end of terrace property. My client had also purchased neighbouring land. Back in the 1960s, the council had compulsorily purchased the other side's plot of land, and we knew that because it was the only conveyance that we had, and that conveyance showed from the plan and from the parcels clause, it was quite clear that the terraced house was still standing. And the parcels clause and plan also said that plot was approximately 50 square yards. But we didn't have the original conveyance dividing the land. We had some historic ordnance survey maps, and it looked as if those terraced houses had been built sometime in the late 19th century, so there was a good chance that ownership had been divided sort of 150 years ago. The council owned the plot for about 50 years until they sold it to the other side. But during their ownership, they'd granted planning permission to my client's predecessor, entitled to demolish the houses that stood on both of the plots and to build a car park. So the buildings had been demolished, the plots were used as one for decades, but the title and the ownership was never actually united, and that was in the 1970s. Fast forward to 2015, my client purchases his land, builds six terraced houses on it, worth a fair sum. Together, the properties are worth in excess of $1 million. And he built them with some external space at the rear of the plots. That's the sort of place that you'd keep your bins, your bicycles, that sort of thing. And that external rear access way you'd get to by walking along a footpath that ran along the end of the terrace, close to the invisible boundary with the council's plot. That footpath was 74 centimetres wide, and that was what we ended up arguing about. So my client started building. Various employees of the council turned up disputing the boundary position. On the first visit, one employee was adamant that the footpath was on the council's land. On the second visit, my client distinctly remembered the second employee saying that the council had decided not to pursue their concerns because the matters were too close to call. So they hadn't agreed where the boundary was. They hadn't agreed that my client was right about where he said the boundary was. They just said they weren't going to take any action. And my client had also had discussions with a third member of the council saying that he didn't care precisely where the boundary was drawn, provided that the footpath was on his land. He thought he might own an extra foot or so beyond that, but it didn't make any difference to him. And this was included within the sales particulars. The council signed off on those, and they explicitly stated that the footpath was not within the plot for sale. The council then sold this plot of land to the respondent, and the plan that they used in that conveyance and that they referred to identify the land included all of the land right up to the terraced building. So it included the footpath. One of the disputes that the court had to deal with was, firstly, what really was said between my client and the council some 7 or 8 years ago, and whether or not this was sufficient to constitute a boundary agreement. The other side hammered home the point that no agreement had actually been reached. There was still a dispute as to where the position of the boundary was, but the court agreed with me that it was sufficient because what they had done was reached an accord. They had decided that the matter was not going to be pursued any further. And this was especially clear when coupled with the clear wording that the council had approved in the sales particulars. When it comes to boundary agreements, one of the things worth bearing in mind is that there may be a further dispute as to whether or not any agreement was intended to bind successors. That is often, but not always, the case. Sometimes any agreement is simply intended as a personal agreement. I think it might be helpful, Dan, if we have a brief chat about what's useful evidence and what's not useful evidence.
Well, Brittany, I have to say I'm pretty impressed. I do feel for the council there, because usually when you're looking at a boundary agreement, the clue's in the name, you're looking for an agreement. And it doesn't seem to me that there was any express agreement there. But I think that's probably helpful, because we shouldn't discount the possibility of a boundary agreement in the absence of there being an express agreement. We can be a bit more creative than that, perhaps, and think about whether there's scope for there being an inferred agreement from conduct. And that could be, as it was in your case, a really useful point to bear in mind.
And actually, there's also a great case called Bean and Katz, which is a 2016 case from the Upper Tribunal, in which it was stated that really boundary agreements are all about averting strife. So if there is evidence that the parties have come to an accord, whether that's inferring from conduct or actually what they agreed was that it just simply wasn't worth pursuing, then as my case shows, there's going to be, that might be sufficient in some instances.
Great. Well, let's talk about evidence. What's useful? What's not so useful? What do you think, Brittany?
As you said, Dan, if you can get the conveyance that initially divides the properties, you should get it. Sometimes it's going to be helpful to try and get the conveyances that came afterwards. They're no replacement for the original dividing conveyance, but they might illustrate how sort of the state of affairs has continued, possibly through the decades, if it's been a while since the properties were initially divided. You've also got to understand the physical features, as you say, as they were, not as they are now, because things may well have changed. Buildings may have been demolished, extended, various walls, trees, etc., long-standing historical boundary points may have been removed or altered. And one of the things that became quite helpful in my case was that you're not just looking at the land as it is, you may well want to look below the ground. So in my case, there were archaeological footings that demonstrated where the terraced houses probably were. And my client had those footings professionally surveyed and plotted on plans that he overlaid with old ordnance survey maps. And that showed that the footings likely represented the terrace that had been demolished. And that helped us to figure out where the boundary had been, because what we knew is that when the properties were standing, the boundary was around the wall that was dividing these terraced buildings. As well as below the ground, you might think about a bird's eye view. For instance, you can look at satellite imagery, and you can also look at historic satellite imagery. There are some great websites nowadays, the Git Mapping website, Historic Aerial England, Google Earth, Google Street View can be incredibly helpful to provide you with a snapshot as to how things have changed over the years.
Street View is great, isn't it? Because you can select now often multiple different years and you can really see how it's changed. I use that quite often.
And it can really help to orientate a judge through the dispute to help the judge see how the parcels have changed over time. There are various things that don't matter. Where later parties think the boundary is doesn't really matter, unless you're talking about things like adverse possession or boundary agreements. Simply your client's position, if they've come to this boundary dispute as to where the boundary is, isn't particularly important when it comes to deciding and helping to decipher where the boundary is. Also, planning permissions don't tend to be particularly relevant. In my case, the other side had gone to great lengths to get permission to produce a second witness statement. And in that witness statement, they complained that what my client had built was actually longer than what planning permission plans had indicated would be built. And they said that this was evidence relevant to the boundary. In that case, the other side had even paid surveyors to go and measure up what had been built and to produce plans illustrating the difference. But this was pointless because the planning application wasn't making a representation as to where the boundary was. So whether what was built was 5 centimetres shorter or longer was irrelevant because none of that actually helped the court decide where the boundary was to begin with. Do you have any other thoughts on that, Dan?
Well, I suppose just to comment on a case that I did recently where it was a difficult case because we did have the original dividing conveyance, but it said almost nothing in the parcels clause about the boundary, and the plan was very roughly sketched, and the measurements on it, there were some measurements, but they'd been handwritten and were partly illegible. But also there were no reference points on the ground from which to take the measurements because the plan had been, or the transfer had been made before the plots had been developed into what subsequently became quite nice detached houses. So the plan and the conveyance was of very little assistance, and there weren't any subsequent transfers that we had access to, and there weren't many historic features on the ground that we could refer to. What had happened in that case was that two neighbours who had lived together amicably for about 15 years had suddenly come into a disagreement because they had, as they later came to regret, agreed with a developer who had purchased land at the rear of their properties. They had agreed to let the developer access their drainage, which went through the backs of their garden, the very rear end of their quite substantial gardens. And in order to do that, the developer had had to remove the boundary features in place at the rear boundary, but also towards the rear of the boundary which separated the two neighbours. Now, the two neighbours with the developer tried to mark out or peg on the ground where the boundary should be reinstated. But after the boundary was reinstated by the developer, a dispute arose over to whether it had been built in the right place or not. Now, whereas the claimants were arguing essentially that the boundary had been agreed between them and their neighbours as being along the historic line, there was no boundary agreement pleaded, so we couldn't really go for a boundary agreement. But we were saying, effectively, the agreed line was in accordance with the historic features, which would have been in accordance with the original conveyance. So there are quite a few steps to the argument. Whereas the other side had produced evidence to show that they had drawn a boundary line along what few historic features remained. There were essentially just two footings from old fence posts which remained, and they used that to draw a line. And that was what they said was the true boundary line. So it can be very difficult in circumstances where you don't have a useful original conveyance. We didn't have evidence, historic satellite images or anything like that. In any event, the amount that was in dispute was so little, it was 2 to 4 inches, I think, at various points. A satellite image isn't going to help because it's going to be too large scale, or too small scale. So a really difficult task for the judge in those circumstances. So really important to think about, what does the original conveyance say? How helpful is it? What evidence have you got? And if you haven't got much evidence, then you've got to go into it knowing that there's a high risk to that litigation. You don't really know which way it's going to go. And so really, it's really important to think about, how can you settle this? How can you mediate? What are the solutions that both parties can live with?
Absolutely. Most of the time in these disputes, but not universally, you will end up with an expert becoming involved. What's your view on the use of experts?
I think experts are really useful and can be really important, but you've got to get their instructions right, because at the end of the day, they're going to be drawing a boundary line in accordance with their instructions. It's not enough just to give them the plans from the title plans from the land registry and ask them to draw a line from that, because the land registry plans are only show general boundaries, so they can't be scaled up even by an expert. So you've got to have your instructions really clear, either by giving them the original conveyance and the original plan, or by giving them evidence of the topographical features as they were at the time of the conveyance, or whatever it might be, the boundary agreement, the adverse possession line, whatever it is. You've just got to have really clear instructions so that you know what the expert's going to produce. And then once you've got a plan which shows the boundary line that you want, that is really helpful to give to a judge, because at the end of the day, the judge has to decide what the boundary line is. And so if you have a plan which is clearly labelled A, B, C, D, then that's really easy for a judge to say, yes, that's the line. We ran into difficulty in the case that I just mentioned because the expert had drawn a line. It wasn't exactly clear why that line had been drawn and how the instructions had been given to him. And then my clients had conceded that that line wasn't correct and was too generous to them, and had argued for a different line. Now, that's really unpalatable for a judge, because you're saying, here, judge, is a line drawn on the plan which you can clearly see, But that's not the correct line. You should draw the line through some of these points, but then via other features on the ground, which puts the judge in a really difficult position. So what you want to be able to do is to give a judge a plan with a clear line on it and say, this is the plan. Please declare the boundary in accordance with this line. What kinds of experts do you think are important, Brittany? And also, what do you think about single joint experts?
If I take your second question first, I think single joint experts can be a great way of really averting disagreement early on, because these sorts of disputes happen between neighbours and they can absolutely ruin your way of life. Even if you go through, litigate the whole thing and the court decides after 18 months, 2 years, that one side is the winner, that doesn't repair the relationship with your neighbour after that. So if there's a dispute and at an early stage, the parties agree, okay, well, let's get an expert involved and let's just agree to be bound by wherever that expert declares the line to be. That's not necessarily without issues, but if you've only been in disagreement for 3 months, perhaps, and the amount of money that you've spent is in the four figures rather than the five figures, it may be a lot easier to repair your relationship after that. As far as the types of experts go, it's really quite amazing the number of times that the expert report that I receive isn't actually the expert report that I need. So quite often people will get surveyors in to map the minute detail of a site as it is now. And that might help me understand the site in great detail. But what that isn't is a commentary on the historic features of the site. And what I really want is a boundary expert who goes through and says, there is a hedge at this point, see photograph A. Because of the growth of the hedge and its nature, I assess it to be this many years old. There is evidence of a historic fence line at this point, see these photographs, and I've plotted it. I think this is about this many years old. There is a wall here, there is a hedge and ditch there, and all of those sorts of things where an expert acknowledges historic features of the site and draws them together to say that in his opinion or her opinion, the line is as plotted between X and Y. That is really helpful, because otherwise, if I'm simply handed a detailed survey plan of the site now, what that doesn't necessarily include is references to, it might say there's a hedge there, but it doesn't tell me how old the hedge might be, whether there's any old fencing in the hedge, which could be a good evidence of a boundary. It doesn't tell me if there's evidence of old fencing that's been replaced, or if the fence that the plan says is in position is 5 years old or 50 years old. So you need to be really careful about the type of expert that you get. And you don't really need them in all disputes. The case that I had in Cheltenham, in fact, didn't have any experts, but that did make me a little bit nervous. So my client had paid surveyors to plot things such as archaeological footings onto plans and to produce overlays, but we didn't have a sort of Part 35 compliant expert report. What we had were a series of professional plans. And that made me slightly nervous, because the other side's, really the entire defence was, firstly, there was no boundary agreement, and even if everything you said was said is accurate, that doesn't constitute an agreement. But the secondary argument was your position as to where the boundary is based on your lay client's evidence, and your lay client can't give expert evidence. So the court shouldn't be accepting his explanations. And I think different judges could have gone different ways on that, because my client was saying, look at these archaeological footings, I think they accord with these overlays, and I think that because of the age of these footings and the overlays, that they are good evidence of where the terraced buildings used to be. There was a wall on the edge of the other side's plot, and my client had given evidence as to how old he thought that wall was, whether he thought it was an original wall. And all of the points that were being made were common sense points, but equally they were points that usually you might have had an expert addressing. In our case, the judge noted that no one had asked for expert evidence through case management, which meant that the other side's point wasn't an attractive argument straight off the bat. And that judge also took the view that he was in as good a position as any to analyse photographs and plans that had been produced and form his own views. And I think one of the clinchers was that the other side weren't offering a competing explanation as to where the boundary was. They were simply saying, the footpath is on our land, but they weren't offering a competing explanation as to the conclusions that could be drawn from the archaeological footings, or as to my client's analysis of the one wall that was standing. So given that there was no real dispute as to the narrative that my client was giving, that made it much easier for the judge to accept that, deem that he was a credible witness experienced in development, and find that even if there hadn't been a boundary agreement, which he said there was, the boundary was where my client had posited that it would have been.
So, Brittany, would you recommend going in to trial without an expert report?
That's generally my preference, because even if we'd had an expert report that said all of the things my client was saying, I wouldn't have had my primary concern, which was that the judge might reject the common sense conclusions because they were being offered by a lay client rather than an expert. It's not always going to be costs proportionate. So in my case, whilst it was only 74 centimetres of 2.5 foot that was in dispute, that was quite important. Firstly, because if that land wasn't part of my client's land, then the purchasers of these 6 terrace buildings couldn't access via sort of the exterior their rear alleyway, so there wasn't a way that they could bring bins in and out without dragging them through the house, and ditto with bicycles. So it was quite important from that point of view. But it was also important to the other side, because they wanted to develop this plot, and in urban Cheltenham, 2.5 foot matters when you're building. So in that case, I think it would have been costs proportionate to produce a report, but perhaps in cases where it is a matter of inches, or even if it's a bit more than that with larger properties, if in fact there's no real value to the dispute, you may consider whether or not you truly need an expert. So bringing things to a close, Dan, do you have any final views to share?
Well, I think it was what you were saying earlier, Brittany, about how important it is to try and knock these disagreements on the head early on. I'll just mention that there is a pre-action protocol, which is not in the CPR. It's not mandatory. You can find it on propertyprotocols.co.uk, and it provides a useful protocol if you're seriously trying to resolve the dispute pre-issue. But I think the key really is to exchange information early on if you think there's a boundary agreement, or if you think there's adverse possession. Get hold of the initial conveyance as soon as possible. That should really be the first thing that you do. And seriously think about trying to agree to instruct a single joint expert to try to plot the boundary as per that original conveyance, or as per whatever boundary agreement or adverse possession claim is being made, and use that as a basis for serious negotiations or even a mediation to try and settle it early on. And the key as well to remember with mediation is that it's so good because there are so many different possible solutions. You can be very creative with how you come up with a solution. So I've got one on at the moment where it's a boundary dispute, but we could quite easily potentially settle it at mediation by agreeing to sell to the other party the small parcel of land in dispute, because it's not really worth anything to us. But we just don't want our neighbour taking our land and using it as they wish. So there's creative ways that you can solve disputes at mediation, which the court simply doesn't have jurisdiction to order at a trial, and that's well worth remembering. But I think with neighbours, it's never about the money at the beginning. It's always about the principle. But by the time you come to trial, it's always about the money, because the costs that are being racked up are quite startling, and often what's in dispute is worth very, very little. So I think if you are advising a client at the early stages of a boundary dispute, it's really important to try and get that dispute in perspective and to manage expectations about the costs, the expense, the time, the delay. involved in getting a boundary dispute to trial so that you can really focus minds on settling things early and everyone's swallowing their pride to an extent to live amicably next to each other.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's rarely worth it. They can cost a huge amount to litigate. It's not unusual for cost spills between the parties to spiral into the £120,000, £150,000 mark. It's normally far more than the land is actually worth. So it may well be helpful finding out how much the land in dispute is worth, what the costs are likely to be, and really hammering home that even if an individual wins, they are never likely to recover all of their costs. Quite often, it might be 70% of the costs that they recover, which can still leave them with a deficit of perhaps £30,000 or so. In most cases, a compromise is possible, but I think that becomes harder to achieve as matters progress. If the cases are privately funded, it may just be that parties cannot afford to settle as time goes in, because by this point they've poured £50,000, £60,000, £70,000 into a case. Whereas if that same settlement had been suggested when we were £5,000, £6,000, £7,000 deep, it would have been far more palatable. It's also important for parties to recognise that it's not just useful to have an amicable relationship with your neighbour. If you are going to sell your property, you do have to disclose disputes. And if you have gone through a boundary dispute, even if that boundary dispute has resolved, if in fact the relationship between you has become so poor that there is constant argument, then you may well have to disclose that when selling a property, which can affect the value and whether or not a purchaser is likely to take your property off your hands.
And ironically, it's probably going to affect the value much more than the piece of land that you're arguing about, often in dispute.
Absolutely. Other things, people should check whether or not their home insurance is going to cover boundary disputes. Some home insurance does, but not all of it. And some of it will only cover you if they've become engaged at a certain stage. And finally, I think on an evidential point of view, as well as getting this initial conveyance, you'll also want to go away and dig through old boxes of photographs, for instance. Do you have a photograph from your child's third birthday party 20 years ago? And in the background, you can see that there is a fence on the other side of the tree and not on this side of the tree. And it would be amazing how photographs such as that, which have sat in a box, sometimes for decades, can actually really give us a huge understanding of how the site has changed. Because also, as Dan said, even if there is historic aerial photography, that's only going to help you if it's perhaps a matter of feet or more that's in dispute. If you're talking about inches or 1 foot, it's unlikely that an image taken from satellite or from a plane is going to really aid you much in that. So from looking in dusty old boxes in the attic to instructing an expert surveyor, hopefully that's given you some things to think about if you become engaged in litigating a boundary dispute.
Great. Well, thanks so much for listening to the Real Estate Pod. If you'd like to find out more about St John's Chambers or to get in touch with us, please go to stjohnschambers.co.uk.